57-3711FT, McDonough versus Department of Workforce Development. Mr. Zimmer, you represent Dr. McDonough.
Dr. McDonough provided medical services under the workers' compensation statutes. The city's insurer claimed that these services were not medically necessary, and proceedings were had under section 102.16 sub 2M, was effective as of the 1st of January 1992.
Counsel, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you. I will have to leave the oral argument for a while. I will be listening to the tapes. I will still be participating. Thank you.
The department determined against Dr. McDonough in its review of the medical necessity of the treatment of the employee, Mr. Brunzel. Then brought an action for judicial review with the circuit court. The statute for medical necessity review provides that judicial review is to be had in the same manner as under section 102.23. Section 102.23 governs the run-of-the-mill workers' compensation case, where the typical procedure is a determination by the department, an appeal to the Labor and Industry Review Commission, and from the commission, then, an appeal to circuit court. However, under the medical necessity review statute, we go directly from the department to circuit court, leapfrogging over the commission. Section 102.23 provides a number of requirements for filing and service, and an important one which we were relying on in initiating this case was the provision for substitute service. Section 102.23 expressly provides that complete service may be had if a copy of the summons of complaint is provided to each party, and that is given to the commission, served upon a commissioner or an agent designated by the commission. We did that. The department has asserted that substitute service is not sufficient despite the language of the statute. Section 102.23 is incorporated by reference into section 102.16, and the case law on incorporation by reference is clear. If you're going to incorporate another statute,
okay,
yeah, I'm waiting to be heard. This happens every Wednesday, so that it's so our enemies know when to attack us.
All right.
So you may continue. There's no
emergency. In cases of incorporation by reference, the incorporated statute is taken as if it had been written verbatim into the referring statute. So it's as if section 102.23 sub 1 were brought directly into the medical necessity review statute. Now, the incorporation by reference of 102.23 poses somewhat of a problem because, as this court has previously identified in the Miller case, section 102.23 is a problematical statute, and the court has gently reminded the legislature that it really ought to take a look at this. What the court has done instead is to compound the problem by making reference to section 102.23 and incorporating it into another statute where it doesn't quite dovetail right.
Are you referring to what the Court of Appeals did?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sir. And in a situation where you have this incorporation by reference, the Legislative Council's note, section 990.001, not only acknowledges that the statutory language is to be brought in verbatim, but also the well-defined meaning and the court interpretations of that statute as they are brought in come with it. Because the line of cases under section 102.23 insists that there must be strict, unyielding, unbending compliance with that statute, we're left with no choice other than to read the statute according to its terms. The Court of Appeals in the Gomez case even stated flat out, section 102.23 plainly requires service on the commission. It's the same language, it's the same statute, it should be interpreted the same. Service on the commission of the proper number of copies should constitute the complete service upon the parties. As this court stated in the Miller case, the goal of these procedural statutes for review is simple, orderly, and uniform system of conducting business in the courts. The interpretation of the statutes which we are urging is simple, it follows the language of the statute, it's orderly, and it's uniform. In all situations where you have an appeal in the manner of section 102.23, you follow the section 102.23 procedure, and it's always the same. The department's interpretation is not simple, and it's not uniform. In some cases, such as under the medical necessity statute, the department insists that, no, what you need to do really is look behind the words statute uses and see if there's some secret intent there, which is what the Court of Appeals did. As the court made clear in the Miller case, the requirements for review under section 102.23 should be clear to lawyers and litigants so that these appeals can be conducted in an orderly fashion.
Counsel, you argue, based on Gomez and the others, but specifically Gomez, that the interprets 102.23 with regard to services. It's plain. The Gomez case says 102.23 plainly requires service on the commission. Well, how about this? That maybe the words of 102.23 are plain. Maybe Gomez doesn't have to be overturned in that respect. But maybe the interplay between sub 25 and sub 16, do I have this right, make it ambiguous. Yes, 16 and 23, rather. 102.23, make it ambiguous. How do you respond to that?
There is a certain ambiguity there because of the way that the two statutes, as I mentioned, don't quite fit together. I would say, though, that it's not necessary to overrule Gomez in order to find that the service was proper. If we look at the way that the department and the commission are set up, under section 15.225, the commission is attached to the department. Under section 15.03 of the statutes, attachment means that the commission is a unit within the department. So you have the universe of the department, and the commission is in that. It's not off to the side here somewhere. It's possible under Gomez to serve the department and not serve the commission. But we submit that it's possible to serve the commission, and any way that you serve the commission, you're simultaneously serving the department too.
Gomez said that service on the department was ineffective. Didn't it say that? I might be wrong.
Yes, that is what Gomez says.
Yeah, but you had to have service on the commission. The statute 102.23 is plain. You have to have service on the commission. That's what 102.23 means. No doubt already decided it, right?
Yes.
And but arguably it's ambiguous when read in context with sub 16. But also legislative intent. Help us. How does it help us with regard to legislative history? Help us with regard to interpreting the intent of the legislation.
legislative history on the medical necessity statute is, as I recall, completely unhelpful. It just refers to using the same procedures under 102.23.
I don't understand how your position makes sense. Because the commission has had nothing to do with this case. They haven't been served, they haven't had to make a decision. It's been all DWD, right?
Right.
But you're saying that under the terms of this statute, once you get an adverse decision from DWD, you can substitute service by filing the papers with an agency clerk. That's had absolutely nothing to do with the case. They look at these papers and they say they don't even have a file on them. Now, does that make sense that the legislature would intend such what appears to be anyway to be an absurdity?
It's not necessarily an absurdity because the commission has the substitute service procedure set up already. They accept substitute service all the time.
Yeah, but for cases that they know what to do with, they've got files.
Yes.
They don't have a file on this case, do they?
No.
I mean, theoretically, they might not even know certainly they don't know who Dr. McDonough is, and they might not even know, probably don't even know who Wausau Business Insurance is. And yet they're somehow getting a substitute service for Wausau Business Insurance. That just doesn't make sense.
What we're trying to do is follow the statute.
I can understand, you know, that you look at the statute and say, well, this is what it does, but then as a second look, you know, now that we've got to interpret the statute, which is our job, and the Court of Appeals' job, we've got to make a determination that makes sense.
I would submit that it would make sense for either the commission as part of the department or the department to be the party that accepts substitute service.
And then what do they do with it once they get these papers? Start getting on the phone and let their fingers do the walking? Okay, who's this Dr. McDonough guy? And who's, let's see now, Wausau Business Insurance. We've got these papers, but we don't have a file. So how do they go about finding that?
Oh, as the affidavits that the state submitted to the trial court indicate, the papers did eventually make their way to the unit which did the medical necessity determination. Not as if they were lost in the abyss somewhere.
Should this court be directing the legislature to write the right words into the statute?
I don't know.
I'm asking, you're suggesting that if it was intended that it be the department rather than the commission, if it was, that they should write the department rather than the commission?
Well, they certainly could have done that, and it wouldn't have been very difficult. The way that the statute is written, especially when it's taken in light of the principle that the legislature is deemed to know the cases which have interpreted the statute, they should be deemed to know that this is how it's being read and that their intent has to be read as following that strict compliance rule.
Let's take a look at subsection present. Of 102.23.
Yes.
Now, that simply says that the submission shall make return to the court of all documents. Papers are filed, right?
Okay. Yes, but sub D is not incorporated by reference into medical necessity statute. It's just sub A, which in turn incorporates sub B.
Yes, but 102.16 2ME incorporates, says that in the same, that we may seek judicial review of that determination in the same manner that compensation claims
are reviewed under 103.23.
Yes.
Okay, so subsection D of 102.23, I'm referring to. Obviously, in a case like this, it's not the commission, even though the statute says the commission shall make return to the court of all the documents, I mean, it's the Department of Workforce Development, right?
Correct.
So with respect at least to subsection D, you would be substituting the DWD for commission?
Yes.
Now, if you did that in subsection D, then why don't you do that in subsection B? B is in void, where it says service upon a commissioner or agent, and some wipe out commissioner or agent and service upon the DWD, complete service.
Well, as the Court of Appeals recognized, the analogy breaks down pretty quickly under the service section, because there aren't any commissioners, and there's no agent appointed to receive service of these medical necessity review commission determinations. The procedure just isn't in place there. And really, this problem is to a large extent caused by the department. We look at Gomez. In that case, the notice of appeal materials told how to go about the appeal, who had to be served, the commission needs to be served, it needs to be served in Madison, gave the address and even the room number of where the commission had to be served. Our notice of appeal rights, which is attached to the complaint in the record, just says that judicial review is had under section 102.23. Under Gomez, there was a commission regulation which once again set up how the review is to be had, where the service is to be had. Under the medical necessity review regulations of the department, there's nothing like that.
In the notice of appeal, there's only reference to the statute, 102.23 in the actual notice of appeal?
Yes.
Quite perplexes me that why these notice of appeals don't have sent it here. I mean, you know, as you say, the workers' comp one does.
Yes.
Very specific.
It would have saved everyone a lot of grief.
Sent it to this address within this amount of time.
The department was interpreting the statute as something other than the literal words of the statute. It should let lawyers and litigants know that. But as it is, the department is no help at all. And I'd also note that the commission did accept the service, and it did get to the proper people at the department. And it's just that Judge Sunby's concurring opinion in Gomez is correct, that if that regulation of the commission 3.06, now 3.05, hadn't existed, the service would be sufficient because it had been accepted by a person who appeared to be authorized to do it, just as the commissioner accepted ours too. And I understand Justice Babbage's comment about this being rather a peculiar reading of the statutes. But at the same time, if you look at the cases that have been decided under Section 102.23, the department will challenge jurisdiction on these appeals for the most silly, trivial, picayune problems. If you look at the Cruz case, it was filed in the right county, but in the caption, they put Milwaukee County instead of Dane County. The department said that that was a jurisdictional defect. In the Nickmore case, even though the appeal was related to the commission, in the caption they put the department rather than the commission. They claimed that that was a jurisdictional defect. If that kind of attitude is going to be taken by the department, I don't see where we have any choice in the outside world but to follow the literal absolute terms of the statute as it's written.
But of course, as I pointed out, it's impossible to follow it literally in all of the sections.
Well, the section that you're referring to, sub D, isn't a jurisdictional requirement. And we'd also submit that even if the court decides to affirm the Court of Appeals, this matter should nonetheless be remanded to the trial court because there's an issue as to whether the department had subject matter jurisdiction in the first place. The department's regulation 80.783 requires that the insurer give a 60-day notice to the medical provider. And if that notice is not given timely, the medical provider is entitled to an order for default judgment from the department. We've alleged that there has been no such notice given in compliance with that regulation. And furthermore, that deprived the department of any competence to act otherwise than to issue an order for default judgment. Just like the notice of appeal, that 60-day notice is jurisdictional. In closing, I'd like to say that the legislature could have written the medical necessity department as the Court of Appeals reads it, but they didn't. All we have are the words of the statute, and the department has hidden its light under a bushel, so to speak, by not giving anyone any guidance as to how this appeal process is to proceed. And as the case law is clear, it's the obligation of the courts to construe the statutes as they are written, not as they ought to have been written. And we have this body of law requiring absolutely strict and unbending compliance. We would submit that following the statute literally, in good faith, should suffice for substitute service. We therefore respectfully request that the Court of Appeals decision be reversed and this matter be remanded to the trial court for the proceedings.
Thank you. Any more questions? Thank you, Mr. Zimmer.
Mr. Nass.
May it please the court, on behalf of the Department of Workforce Development, responded to this matter. I am Lowell E. Noss, Assistant Attorney General. It is the position of the department that the court does not have competency to proceed where the plaintiff in this matter failed to commence an action against the insurer, Wausau Business Insurance Company, a necessary and adverse party by service of an authenticated summons and complaint within 30 days after the date of the department's order, dated March 31st, 1977. Deadline for commencing that action by service of a filed authenticated summons and complaint would have been April 30th, 1997. The insurance company in this matter was first served, as acknowledged by the petitioner, on May 5th, 1997. There is no assertion of a delay in the receipt of the department's order of March 31st. And as a matter of fact, Exhibit C, which is attached to the plaintiff's complaint at Record 117, and I would ask the marshal, for the convenience of the court, to distribute to the court copies of the department's order attached as Exhibit C to the complaint in the matter. If one looks at that, you'll notice that in the upper right-hand corner is date stamped April is abbreviated APR, period, 2, 1997, suggesting, coming from the petitioner, that this was apparently the date of its receipt by its recipient, Dr. McDonough. But the plaintiff was not misled as to the time element for commencing this action. As acknowledged on page 7 of his initial brief, he instructed the Marathon County Sheriff's Department to serve the insurance company by April 30th, 1997. So we have the correct insurance company identified, and we have a realization of the time for service. No one was misled.
Well, perhaps at least your opposing counsel thinks he was misled. By saying that he followed the literal words of the statute, which have been interpreted by many cases as clear and unambiguous. Let me tell you what my problem is. Couple problems. One is, I'm looking at what you just gave to us, and the very last sentences. This order becomes final within 30 days, and the only reference to appeal rights is that set forth under 102.23.1a. Why doesn't the department set forth, if you're going to interpret the statute differently than the plain words of the statute, why don't you advise parties that you're interpreting it, you're substituting words for what has been deemed the plain meaning of the statute? Why don't you do that?
Well, it could, but then again, I'm reminded of the language of in the Wiesenthal decision at 179 this second at 645, where the Court of Appeals said, we will not fault the Department of Health and Social Services or any agency for not referring the petitioner to Section 227.53 of the statute for additional information. The Court of Appeals went on to say, agencies can easily fall into the trap of misleading a party when they attempt to condense or simplify pertinent information not in the statute.
That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the words of the statute say the commission. It's clear commission means the commission, which has meant the commission for years. And you're saying your interpretation is different from that. And how is anyone reading those statutes know that your interpretation is different? And if you want it to be different, why don't you tell people other than setting a trap?
Perhaps if you look at the overall purpose of the legislation was to have a quick, expedited remedy on payment of fees for health care providers without a hearing, without the time delay involved that you normally have, and to have an expedited system. And I can only suggest, as far as the legislative history, is that that theme of an expedited system carried over to the economy of words when it came time for establishing the appeal. It's the only suggestion I can get to this court.
Hard for me. And if I were an attorney sitting in an office in Amory, Wisconsin, or Cumberland, Wisconsin, or Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I read the statutes and knew that this service was set up for years and years and years and years, this is the way it's done. And for years and years and years and years, the department has been pretty picky-uni about that statute and said, you got to dot every I and cross every T. And now the department is saying, ha-ha, but we're going to change your word and not tell anyone about it. It just doesn't seem right.
Well, it may not seem right, but you have to look at the overall dimensions of 102.23, Justice Bradley. And that is, and I know the Justice has a long acquaintance with Chapter 102, the substitute service under 102.23 isn't the required method. It's there, it's available. The subsection B says it shall be served on the parties. And many litigants under 102.23 avail themselves of direct service of insurance carriers or employees by sheriff's service rather than rely simply on LIRP. Others use the substitute service under LIRP. Some use both, as here. But it's simply an alternative method of service. There's no preclusion of serving someone under Section 801 by having sheriff service directly. As a matter of fact, that's how the department was served in this matter. Direct service of a single summons and complaint. It's simply an alternative method of service.
I know. And
petitioner, in this case,
both.
Knew it.
And use both. I mean, my sense is that the attorney, and of course we're not weighing this necessarily, but my sense is, you know, the attorney served the parties to the sheriff's department, did it the right way, and that is even advised the sheriff's department by what date, got to have it. Then the attorney and he said, but no, I'm not going to trust that. I'm going to do everything I can. I'm going to follow the statute exactly the way it's written, exactly the way that it's been done for years and years and years. And as a backup to be extra safe and secure, I'm going to do substitute service. So, I mean, the argument that it's only substitute service in this situation just doesn't seem to play out as it does both.
But relying on an interpretation of literally serving the commission using substitute service, as I suggested, was a problem in my brief, becomes a real problem because, as Justice Babich noted earlier, the commission has absolutely no file on this. They don't know who the parties are. And it's important here where you, the plaintiff, also failed to name and join the employee, in this case, William Brunzell, B-R-U-N-Z-E-L-L, as a defendant, although he is identified in the complaint. But if you look at the copy of the order of the commission, you will notice that Brunzell is identified as the employee in that matter. It's important because under the department's own administrative rules, DWD 80.73 print 9 of the administrative code, the department may initiate one of these necessity dispute actions not only at the request of a healthcare provider like Dr. McDonough, but also for the insurer or the injured employee. It's submitted that since the subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time, plaintiff's failure to name and join the employee, in this case, named in the department's order, highlights the reason why the substitute service on the commission provisions should not be applied here. This is especially so where plaintiff's complaint appears to repeatedly assert constitutional challenges to the processes and statute involved here. Petitioner belatedly raises in his reply brief the argument that the sunburst exception to the Blackstonian doctrine should excuse the tardy service upon the insurer. But that rule only applies, as this court knows, to situations where the court overrules or repudiates an earlier reported decision. That is not involved here. Page 2 of the petitioner's reply brief continues its erroneous statement that both the time limit and the substitute service provision are found in the very same sentence of the statute. But if the court once again looks at the statute, the time limit of 30 days is in subsection A, and the substitute service provision is the third sentence in section B. I would suggest that the petitioner misreads the Gomez decision in an attempt to benefit himself. In Gomez, the Court of Appeals at page 692 specifically noted that the commission is a related but a very different agency. In section 15.03 of the statutes, the legislature has said that any commission shall be a distinct unit of a department to which it is attached for budgetary purposes, program coordination, and related management functions. But it's a distinct unit, and in Gomez, the Court of Appeals identified the commission as a very different agency.
At 693 in Gomez, the court, after having said it's distinct, says, look, they can serve the department. When the language of the statute clearly says the commission, you're out. It says, we acknowledge the, because you dot the I and cross the T's, we acknowledge the harshness of the result,
for it denies Gomez the opportunity for judicial review of the commission's decision. The cases are clear, however, that the statutory procedures must be strictly followed. And then there's this, that's what you've done for years and years and years. That's my problem. The cases are clear. Let's say the language is clear. You have to have strict compliance. And here you've got a guy who's doing strict compliance, and you say, but the language isn't clear, and you shouldn't strictly comply.
Can you have it both ways?
Yes, you can have it both ways, because as the court noted earlier, it appears there's ambiguity here. And if one looks at subsection B of 102.23, sub 1, as I argue in my brief, the substitute service system of serving the commission states, service upon a commissioner or agent authorized by the commission to accept service constitutes complete service on all parties, but there shall be left with the person so served as many copies of the summons and complaint as there are defendants, and the commission shall mail one copy to each, and here I use bold print in my brief, to each other defendant. Implies, the substitute service section clearly implies it involves the commission as a required, necessary, and adverse defendant. It is not necessary and adverse in this matter, and I would suggest if you're going to read it literally, it can only apply to cases where the commission is one properly, one of the necessary and adverse defendants, file record of addresses, so it doesn't have to guess. Even as in this case, where the employee is not named as a defendant.
Mr. Ness, is it your position that there is authority for a substitute servicer?
It wasn't necessarily my position at the Court of Appeals level, but the Court of Appeals said it so eloquently, I certainly have nothing against it, and it sounds reasonable to me that if you're going to have this with substitute service, you just plug in the commission, the department for the commission on these expedited matters. The affidavit of Ms. Earle that I have, that's in the record, a department employee who maintains the record log, clearly indicates that the department keeps a law of the summons and complaints served on the department and the dates, and also importantly, the number of pleadings served on them.
So your answer is yes?
My answer is yes.
I didn't have the benefit of, I didn't look at the Court of Appeals brief. In the Court of Appeals, you were arguing that there was no such thing as substituted service?
On the commission. And I didn't necessarily, if I remember correctly, and I do not believe that I argued necessarily that to the Court of Appeals that the substitute, what I argued was that the substitute provision certainly did not apply to the commission, and the commission could do it. What I argued was that there was nothing in the record, and the burden is on the petitioner in this matter, there was nothing in the record to indicate when the Department of Workforce Development got the several copies of the summons and complaint that would have been shipped over from work around the Beltline over to DWD here on the square, because as the affidavit of Ms. Earle indicated, anything sent over by interdepartmental mail between the agencies would not be logged in on her log and timestamped. I argued that there was simply no way of determining it. And since the burden is on the plaintiff, the petitioner here in this matter, as to when the department received several copies of the sums of complaint under a substitute service scheme, that attempt would fail. That was my argument, and however, I do agree that by reading, substituting in, one could arrive at that conclusion. But there's no proof in this matter as to when and how it was done.
Is Lurk ever an agent of the Department of Workforce Development?
I would suggest it could be under a standard 10223 case. If, for instance, DWD was an employer of a state employee injured, and DWD would be a litigant before, it would be a state employee, but in fact would be a DWD employee, I would suggest that under a standard workers' comp scenario, in that, but there, the appeal would be taken on a petition for review to the commission. The commission would have authority to make the ultimate fact-finding decision, and then ultimately a judicial review could be obtained under 10223. I see it under that scenario.
So under that scenario, when it's appealed to the circuit court, then the commission could be the agent of the department, is that what you're saying?
Well, not agent. For the substitute service, just as in every other case, the commission would have a file. It would have a file because it was a decision maker in that matter, and it could then look to its file. It would note that the state of Wisconsin is the employer, and the specific agency of employment was DWD. The state is self-insured. It would have that information. It would have names, addresses from the workers' comp file that came up and was before it. I can see that as a possibility. But that, again, is a standard mine-run workers' comp judicial review where the commission is the ultimate decision-maker. Unlike the case here where the commission has absolutely no involvement. In the Gomez decision that's been talked about includes Sunnyview, quite a bit of language from the Sunnyview Village decision, which was 104 with second at 396, and basically there the criticism of the Supreme Court at page 412 stated that a person aggrieved by an administrative decision should not have to guess which government agency to name and serve as a respondent in the proceedings for judicial review. Well, I would suggest in this particular case they didn't have to guess because they properly identified Department of Workforce Development. They instruct the sheriff of Marathon County to timely serve the insurance company by April 30th, 1997. There was no confusion. They were not misled. It simply broke down on execution, unfortunately. In their reply brief, the petitioner continues its assertion unfounded in the record that the Department of Workforce Development has no system involved, no such system established for the substitute service, similar to what the commission does. Yet, as the affidavit that I have pointed out that is submitted earlier in the record of Ms. Dawn Earl, an employee of DWD, indicates that the department obviously is accustomed to being served with summons and complaint because they have a logbook as a responsible government agency, and they record the date they're served, the identity, and they also include the numbers of copies of summons and complaints that are served on them. I guess I would raise the question, why would the department go to the trouble of having a log if it served no purpose? Therefore, I would respectfully request that the court affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals in this matter,
Before you conclude, Mr. Ness, on page 22 of the petitioner's brief, Mr. McDonald raises an issue that he says the Court of Appeals did not address, which is this 30-day requirement. How do you answer that argument?
On what page is that?
Page 22, sub 4 of the petitioner's brief. He says essentially it's good for the goose, good for the gander argument.
Well, of course, what he's doing is saying, as the court has indicated, if the department is going to raise the 30-day time limit now, then very similarly, this court should somehow determine that it has competency to proceed to address the merits of the case. And that, I would suggest, is part of what he's alleging to be the merits of the case. As this court has repeatedly said, that if the court doesn't have competency to proceed, you can't proceed to the merits, but you must go ahead and address the jurisdictional issue. And if the jurisdiction fails, you can't go beyond that. So in that case, I guess the old adage about the goose and the gander just simply doesn't apply, because this court has talked rather in terms of what actually can the court go ahead and address anything on the merits of the case if there's a jurisdictional defect. And the answer is no. Any other questions?
Thank you. I'm sorry. I was somewhat struck by your observation that the court need not publish its opinion in this case. Why did you say that?
Well, that's an interesting question, because as you know, normally, I guess with the exception of probably some criminal cases and a few procedural cases, the court normally publishes. But the rationale is this. The Court of Appeals decision was not recommended, nor is to be published by the decision of the committee. So if the Court of Appeals decision isn't there to be published, doesn't create any interference with any interpretation in terms of Gomez, so forth, there's no need for a decision here. Frankly, reconsidering the position on that, I certainly wouldn't have any objection if the court published it. My rationale is based simply because the Court of Appeals was not going to be published.
It seems like if it's not published, one of the best-kept secrets in state government. We're not going to tell them on the notice of appeal where to really appeal. We're not going to tell them any published case what to do.
Well, if Justice Bradley could tell me which way the case is going to come out, perhaps I could tell her whether or not I want it published.
Fair enough.
With my appearance of it. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Zimmer,
thank you, Your Honor. The department has asserted that no one was misled here. Well, I feel like I've been misled. We've got a statute that says you serve the commission. We've got a long line of cases where the department insists that you follow the statute exactly, and you've got to serve the commission. When I was much younger, I was in New York City, and I was watching these folks on the street, and they were playing a game of three-card Monte, where the guy spins the cards around and can't find the ace. It's like, you try to watch where the card is that's got the ace, but no matter what you did, how close you watched, you couldn't find the ace. It was always a two. And I feel that's like what the state's trying to do here. They're moving the cards for jurisdiction and not telling anyone And the rest of us out here in the public are pretty much just helpless in face of it. When we say that, when Mr. Nass says that we were not misled because we knew that we had to serve the department, or that we had to join the department as a party, we joined the department as a party, we joined the commission as a party, because that wasn't clear either. We covered both of those. Now we're hearing for the first time they think the employee should be a party, which I don't fathom at all, because the employee wasn't involved in this in any respect.
Well, counsel, you know, I am not unsympathetic. I look at the statute and it's I think, very difficult to be anything other than sympathetic. But how do you answer the question, the problem that I posed earlier, that interpretation doesn't make sense, you know, to serve the commission, because they've had no part of this case. Now, I know that, if I got this case, I could write it and say, well, literally, it says you got to serve the commission. But then I'm going to have to answer the question of why this is not an absurd result. Tell me why it's not an absurd result, other than that it's the literal meaning of the literal words of the statute.
I'd say it's not an absurd result because, as I mentioned before, the commission has in place a system for doing this.
We don't know
they
that.
They accept substitute service.
For the commission?
For all the parties, including the department.
From the department, from DWD?
Yes.
On necessity appeals?
In any workers' comp case, if the department is going to be a party, the commission can accept substitute service for the department. The statement that the service statute is in the same section, same sentence as the 30-day timeline. The 30-day timeline states statute in section 102.23 sub 1 sub A states that the action must be commenced by filing and serving as provided in sub B, which is our substitute service provision, upon all parties. So it's incorporated in, it's in that same sentence. Ms. Earle's affidavit, while it says that they keep a logbook of summons and complaints that are received, there's no indication that that was a log that was instituted because of the medical necessity review statute. That just seems to be what they do as a way of generally doing business. The affidavit doesn't say anything about accepting substitute service. In summary, I'd like to say that this has just created a situation where it's incredibly difficult to tell who is the proper party to serve in this situation. And I don't feel that it should be the problem of the litigants when the department is attempting to hide the proper procedure or what it thinks is the proper procedure. I can certainly bet my bottom dollar that if we had tried to do substitute service on the department, that they would be in here now arguing that we did not follow the strict language of the statute and serve the commission. And you look at cases like Cruz and Ningbor, and you know that's true. They're going to come up with the most silly, ridiculous reason for depriving the court of any jurisdiction to proceed. And we submit that that is not fair. We did everything humanly possible to get this thing properly served, and my time is up.
Thank you. Any other questions?
No. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Court stands recess at 1:45.
I've got my class too. They're going to be something itself.